Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments lined up for tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear an interview recorded earlier today with Patrick Coburn, who is the Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper and author of a new book, a biography, a little more than a biography, really, since he doesn't even appear until halfway through the book, of Muqtada al-Sadr, the leader of the Mahdi army, who's been led a rebellion, which caused a lot of distress in Basra and in Baghdad over the last few weeks. Very well-timed book by Patrick Coburn, just out from Scribner's. We will get the background on Shiism and Muqtada and the Mahdi army and what his role is in Iraq's past, present, and future. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined in the studio by Miriam Greenberg, who is the author of a new book called Branding New York, How a City in Crisis Was Sold to the World. She is a professor of sociology at UC Santa Cruz, but she is the book is about how New York reinvented its image in the run-up and wake of its fiscal crisis in the mid-1970s and became a kind of model of the neoliberal city. I've often thought that that whole fiscal crisis period of New York was really a dress rehearsal for the imposition of Reaganism in the United States and really the whole rollback of the welfare state and what Barack Obama called the excesses of the 60s and 1970s. And the New York City fiscal crisis, a very important early stage, early battle in that that rollback. So be interesting to hear this perspective from Miriam Greenberg, that in about half an hour. Before we get to all that, though, earlier this week on Thursday, Tuesday to be precise, the stock market got very excited when a couple of big banks announced more huge losses on mortgage-related investments. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 400 points because investors, always quick to look at the bright side of things, took this as a sign that the worst was finally behind us. Never mind that one of the banks, UBS, has already been here before and was coming back for second helpings of red ink. And never mind that we've had a lot of these one-day binge rallies before in exactly the same rationale, which has proven premature every time. I doubt this will all be over until loss announcements are greeted with either indifference or despair. This is all far from over. It was reported earlier this week that the Federal Reserve is studying the precedent of the Nordic banking crisis in the early 1990s as a way of dealing with our present situation. If they plan to apply anything they learned from that course of study, Wall Street should keep the champagne corked for several more years. Let's take a look at the Swedish example. What follows is cribbed from a 1999 paper on the topic by the economist Peter Englund. After decades of tight regulation, Sweden deregulated its financial system in the early 1980s. This unleashed a fierce speculative boom in stocks and real estate, especially real estate. House prices, for example, nearly doubled in the late 1980s, which is roughly what happened in the U.S. in the late 90s and early 2000s. And as it was true in our case, nothing in the economic or demographic fundamentals could explain the boom. There was no increase in population growth or household formation or any significant rise in building costs. It was all animal spirits, in Keynes's great phrase. Then, suddenly, a Swedish mortgage lender had trouble rolling over its debts around 1991. That is, as was the case here, banks were borrowing money using short-term instruments and then turning around and lending the proceeds to long-term borrowers, which is what mortgages are all about. This is a very bad practice, borrowing short to lend long in the jargon of the trade, but people never stop doing it. If you have trouble raising new cash when your old loan matures, you're suddenly in big trouble. So when the Swedish mortgage lender hit a wall, the whole financial universe in that little country panicked, and suddenly it was crisis time. The stock market crashed, and so did real estate prices. It soon became impossible for businesses to get ordinary loans, which makes it nearly impossible to do day-to-day business, and the economy went into a deep recession. The Swedish government stepped in fairly quickly. The policy was to save the banks, but not their owners, so shareholders of the most troubled institutions were wiped out. But the government pumped 65 billion kroner, which is about $11 billion at 1991 exchange rates, or 4% of Swedish GDP into the banks to keep them afloat. 4% of GDP is a huge number. Here it would be about $500-600 billion. England emphasizes two important points about the bailout. One is that it was done quickly, with almost universal political support. And the other is that the shareholders of the rescued banks were wiped out. There was no dickering a la Bear Stearns when the Fed first got J.P. Morgan to offer $2 a share, but then relented and allowed Morgan to offer $10 because Bear's shareholders whined so loudly. To resolve the crisis, the government created a holding company that took over the bank's bad loans and some of the underlying real estate assets. These were mostly sold again in the open market in 1995 and 96. By 1997, the process was wound up. The final bill to taxpayers after gains on those asset sales was about 2% of GDP, which in the U.S. would be about $250 to $300 billion. The emergency response was not enough to prevent a recession. GDP went deeply negative between 1991 and 93, leading to a total contraction of over 5%. That's roughly twice as deep as the 1974, 75, and 81, 82 recessions in the U.S., which are the worst post-World War II slumps that we've experienced. But although there was a credit crunch, it was short-lived, and the Swedish economy recovered. GDP growth in the 1990s ended up being actually higher than it was in the 1980s and averaged a highly respectable 3.4% a year in the second half of the decade, about what the U.S. did at the time when it was allegedly experiencing a wondrous miracle economy. Contrast that recovery with Japan's dismal performance in the 90s. That country dithered after its asset bubbles burst in the late 1980s, never really moving decisively in to close failing banks and to recapitalize the survivors. The result was a sub-1% average growth rate for the 1990s, a performance that's barely improved in the 2000s. So if we want to avoid something like the Japanese scenario, a long period of slow growth and rising unemployment, the lessons are clear. Move quickly to recapitalize failing banks while not sparing the shareholders. Oh, and we'd really badly need to re-regulate our financial system so this doesn't happen again. I doubt that anything like that is about to happen, certainly while Bush is in the White House. But even should a Dem take office in January, I don't think we're going to see much either, without, that is, a serious worsening of the crisis or serious popular pressure to do so. Now, some shorter-term economic news. This morning, the Labor Department reported that the first-time applications for unemployment insurance last week rose 38,000 to 407,000. That's the highest level in 5 years. Cracking the 400,000 level is of some significance, not just psychologically. It's about where we'd be if we were 3 or 4 months into a recession, which is where I think we are. There may be some problems with adjusting the claims figures for the Easter holiday, so this sharp rise may be a bit of a blip, but the job market is still clearly deteriorating. Tomorrow morning brings the release of the employment numbers for March. I'm expecting another month of job losses and an upward move in the unemployment rate towards 5%. I don't think we're going to see a bloodletting. Instead, I'm expecting to see a long, slow leak. It's not going to feel good. We need a serious public spending initiative to reverse this slide, but our political system seems incapable of even thinking about that. Okay, let's take a musical break. And that's some of the Gigue from the Partita No. 2 in D minor for solo violin by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Henrik Schiering. And now, an interview recorded earlier today with Patrick Coburn, who is the author of Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq, just published by Scribner's. His day job is as the Middle Eastern correspondent for the Independent newspaper in London. And I apologize for the sound quality on his end. He was staying in a hotel that seemed to have a tin can and strings instead of a phone system. This is nothing that had anything to do with my equipment, just nothing I could do about it. But I thought the interview was important enough that we put up with something less than perfect fidelity. Patrick Coburn. Let's start with a little background on Shiism. It is, as you describe it, something of a theology of the downtrodden, and also one in which there's a lot of defeats of hundreds and thousands of years ago actually live on today. What is the significance of this in producing Muqtada of today? Let's start with a little background on Shiism. It is, as you describe it, something of a theology of the downtrodden, and also one in which there's a lot of defeats of hundreds and thousands of years ago actually live on today. What is the significance of this in producing Muqtada of today?
Well, the Shia, I mean, to be oversimplified, have always been the Muslims who were out of power and had a theology which helped them enable them to resist the authorities. It isn't true everywhere, because in Iran, since the beginning of the 15th century, an incoming dynasty had imposed Shiism on the country. But overall, it's a religion which is, at least in theory, opposed to authority.
But it wasn't until fairly recently a theology of rebellion, was it?
No, I mean, it fitted in fairly well with that. It had its own sort of separate clergy from the government. Compared to Sunni Islam, it where the clergy are generally close to being government officials, Shiism has always been much more dissenting.
Then how did the Iranian Revolution change all that?
Well, you know, there have been attempts to have an Islamic revolution really since the 19th century. Islam was always trying to adapt to how it could deal with European and powers invading the Middle East and elsewhere, trying to adapt to cope with the modern world. And it had never really succeeded until Khomeini overthrew the Shah in the 1970s. Suddenly you had what appeared to be a very powerful state with lots of money from oil, with a ferocious security service, is overthrown by a cleric backed by gigantic street demonstrations.
How did Saddam negotiate all these sectarian divisions within Iraq during his the period in which he flourished, you might say?
He didn't really negotiate them. Iraq has always been divided between Kurd, Sunni, and Shia. Saddam himself was a Sunni, Sunni from the countryside, strong tribal background, and the regime always remained primarily Sunni. But it wasn't completely sectarian. The Shia had some of the jobs. There was a long-term rebellion of the Kurds, ferociously crushed with great cruelty by Saddam in the 1980s. 1989, 180,000 people were killed. In 1991, the uprising of the Shia at the end of the Gulf War, maybe another 100,000 Shia were killed. So a lot of Iraqis these days speak as if there wasn't a sectarian tradition in Iraq, but it was certainly there.
You know, we often hear people say that, people intermarried. There was none of this, and it was only the U.S. invasion that really unleashed all these sectarian divisions. That's not true.
No, some people intermarried among the middle class, but among the masses, no, they didn't. You know, it's overstated. You know, was the U.S. presence, did it do any, you know, did it widen the divisions? Yes, it did, because usually you've got a foreign power comes in and occupies a country. Then, you know, one of the communities, usually the smaller community, latches itself onto the occupying power. Suddenly, you know, you have a Sunni army officer who's been kicked out of his job in 2003. He has a Shia neighbor. He knows that neighbor is a different community, but that Shia neighbor goes and gets a job as a policeman. Suddenly he isn't just a Shia, he's a traitor as well. And if you have that happening all over the country, it makes sectarian and ethnic divisions much deeper and much more hostile.
All right, let's focus on Mokhtar's son. What about his personal ancestry? He has got some fairly important ancestors and is reputed by his followers to be something of a demigod, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Mokhtar suddenly emerged, or appeared to suddenly emerge with the fall of Saddam. Nobody, and I think in Washington, you could have asked if all the so-called experts there, they would never have heard of him. But the reason Mokhtar suddenly took over a big chunk of Iraq was because of his family and his family name. The al-Sadrs were the religious leaders who really had fought Saddam for a long time. Saddam's father, Mokhtar's father, Mohammed Sadiq, had created this mass movement again, which initially Saddam thought was going to be anti-American and supportive of the regime. And late in the day, he realized that he'd been cultivating a very dangerous enemy. So he had Mokhtar's father and his two sons assassinated in 1999. Mokhtar's father-in-law was another famous Shia leader called Mohammed Bakr al-Sadr, who was a theologian again, was executed along with his sister by Saddam in 1980. So Mokhtar was backed, A, by this tradition of his family providing the great martyrs of the Shia faith, and secondly, his father had created a mass movement, which, although very badly battered, sort of still existed when the U.S. invaded and overthrew Saddam.
Okay, and when that happened, Mokhtar's rather surprisingly to a lot of people in the West, burst on the scene. What was the path of his rise to fame?
Well, you know, suddenly there was this guy, I mean, who nobody had seen, seemed very young, he's only 34 now, who seemed very important, who'd taken over Sadr City, who'd taken over most of Najaf and a lot of southern Iraq. And it was kind of the people who'd been prominent in his father's movement who suddenly became, you know, local clerics, local leaders. They were moving in a vacuum after the collapse of Saddam's regime. But Turner had sort of been under house arrest since his father was assassinated in 1999. I mean, the people around him say he couldn't do much. He was very closely watched. But he had got a little political experience under his father. He'd sort of run his office. He'd run his magazine. You know, it's often said, there's an American journalistic cliche which says that Mokhtar was a firebrand, a maverick, but actually he was an experienced political operator. And since the beginning, his main theme has been opposition to the U.S. occupation.
Well, it's funny, the firebrand thing. Certainly, the cover picture on the book draws on that reputation. But as you point out, he also knows when to retreat and to lie low, doesn't he?
Sure, yes. I mean, which is kind of what we've seen over the last week. He's somebody who doesn't like to be boxed in. We saw during 2004, he was besieged twice by U.S. Marines in Najaf. And each time he was sort of maneuvering to get out of it, to have a compromise which would keep his militia, the Mehdi army, intact with their arms, to give some ground but not give up too much political ground. He's somebody who is always sort of looking for a compromise, never wanting to get trapped. And we saw that again over the last week after his men had been pretty successful against the Iraqi army in Basra and Baghdad, that he immediately called his men off the streets. Doesn't want to pursue a victory too far. Wants to take his gains immediately. So his track record is as of a pretty successful politician.
Yeah, what happened over the last few weeks? What caused this sudden uprising in Basra and around Sadr City?
Well, the uprising was really a reaction that the Iraqi Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, announced to the surprise of everybody that he was going to take over Basra, he was going to smash the militias there. It turned out that it was the Mehdi army was the only one he was targeting, that they had 72 hours to hand over their weapons. And what was surprising was that Maliki actually thought he could do this, but really at the end of 72 hours of Iraqis were watching on their television pictures of Iraqi army and police handing over their weapons to the Mehdi army and getting sprigs of olive tree and copies of the Quran in return. So it was a pretty humiliating setback.
What has this done to the government, then?
I think it's weakened it to a degree, partly because Maliki made such boastful statements about what he was going to do, and suddenly he isn't able to get anywhere. The army wasn't able to fight its way into the Shia slums in Baghdad or Basra. Muqtada reacted by, or his movement reacted to the attack in Basra by having a what was close to an uprising in the rest of Iraq. They took over probably half Baghdad and other big cities in southern Iraq. So it shows they're very strong and well organized. And the Iraqi army is weaker than we thought it was.
I'm speaking with Patrick Coburn, Middle Eastern correspondent for the Independent newspaper and author of Muqtada, a biography of Muqtada al-Sadr, just out from Scribner's. Now, what are Muqtada's intentions, do you suppose? What's his long-term political goal?
Well, the main one is pretty simple. That he's, you know, he's been against he's the one Shia leader who's been against the occupation from the beginning. He wants that to end. You know, he also leads a religious party. But then that's true of the Iraqi government as a whole. I mean, Maliki, the prime minister, belongs to Dawah, which is a religious party. Its main ally is the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which is also a religious party. So the real difference between him and the others is the attitude to the American presence.
Of course, the popular line in the United States now is that the surge worked and that Iraq is turning some sort of corner. The events of the last week or two have somewhat undermined that perception, but not fully around here. What do you think of that?
Well, it's despairing. You know, I was in Baghdad about 2 weeks ago. You know, it's a bit better than it was before, but one could, this was before the present round of fighting. You know, what you have to define better is, you know, in March 2000, according to the official figure, it's probably an underestimate, is that 2,000 Iraqi civilians were killed. Now, that, of course, is better than a year, 18 months ago, when about 3,000 were being killed every month. But, you know, we've moved from 100% bloodbath to two-thirds of a bloodbath. So, you know, it really is extraordinary. When I was there, for instance, Senator McCain was there, and the Vice President, Dick Cheney, was there, and saying how much better things were. But, you know, they closed down while they were there. They closed down part of Baghdad. You know, you couldn't move on the streets. So they closed down Baghdad outside the Green Zone. They did the same inside the Green Zone. You know, even American officers trying to go back to their offices were being held up at U.S. checkpoints and told, you know, you can't come in. There's a DV here, which means distinguished visitor. So I think that these visits give a very exaggerated sense of any return to normality.
The American media are very gullible, though. There was some question over the years of just how much in control of his militia Muqtada is. What's your diagnosis of that?
Well, you know, last year he called a ceasefire in August for 6 months, and it was obeyed. Then it was renewed in February, and again it was obeyed. Then he called his men out 10 days ago. They came out, fought very hard. Then he called, told them to go back home again, and it was obeyed again. So, and this, on the crucial question is, you know, does he control them? The answer is he clearly does. I think the control has grown. I mean, during 2006, 2007, during the savage fighting between Sunni and Shia in Baghdad, the Mehdi army had become a sort of umbrella group for including death squads and criminals and local Shia warlords. Muqtada said that he's trying to clean it up, to purge it, and to some extent that seems to have succeeded.
What is daily life in Baghdad like now? Is there any trace of normality to it?
Well, little. The city is divided into sort of really ghettos with large concrete walls separating them from each other. Sunni and Shia don't really meet. There is, you know, the slightly less fighting Those are places I was able to go last a couple of weeks ago that I couldn't have gone a year earlier, in Al-Mansour, for instance, and one area, Yarmouk, where the local hospital was used to be controlled by the Mehdi army, and then down the road there was a place where the Sunni would kill any Shia they found in a car. But I was driving through there, and they were pretty quiet. But yeah, I also have to say that a week later, I couldn't have driven there because there was a complete curfew, and a friend of mine who was in Al-Mansour, which is quite used to be, isn't an upmarket district, doing some shopping, suddenly some vehicles with dark windows came by. He thought there must be some senior officials in them. The windows came down. It's the Mehdi army opening up on the police. So, you know, the normality was fragile before, and the idea that the surge had really led to a turning point in Baghdad, it has turned out to be a fantasy. I mean, unfortunately, I mean, I wish things were better, but they just aren't.
You conclude the book by describing Iraq as a pretty much a thoroughly fragmented country. Is that what its future is?
It's difficult to see, after you've had this sort of mass slaughter, how people are going to get back together again. You know, Baghdad, you don't have many mixed areas left. It's mostly Sunni and Shia. The Sunni have been pushed into smaller enclaves. The same is true of central Iraq. So it's difficult to see how trust could ever be reestablished. I think you'll have a federation. There are some things that are still there, for instance, sharing the oil revenues. But it's difficult to see how there could be more than a federation. And in Kurdistan in the north, if an Arab from Baghdad wants to go to Kurdistan, then it's as difficult for him to enter Kurdistan as it is to enter any foreign country.
The American and British ambitions to have Iraqi troops replace the occupying army seem to have taken a very severe blow as a result of this recent uprising. Is this going to change their policy at all?
I suppose so. I mean, they've always said that this is going to happen, but they've been saying that's going to happen for the last 5 years, and it hasn't yet. The problem with the Iraqi army is, first of all, it reflects the divisions in society. Secondly, it's tainted because it's seen as the instrument of the pawn of the occupier of the U.S. And thirdly, the organization wasn't too great. I mean, for instance, in the fighting in Basra, you know, supply for the Iraqi army has been privatized, so it goes to local contractors. But the local contractors said, hold on, there are curfews and it's very dangerous. We can't go out and supply you with what you need. So the army suddenly didn't get enough to eat. So you have an army which, certainly on the record of the last 10 days, is pretty ineffective.
Do they have any other motive other than collecting a paycheck to be part of the army?
That's the main reason. You know, it's the main reason for, you know, Iraq, 50% of the population is unemployed. People are desperate for jobs. Also, their families, extended families, are very dependent on them, so they're rather keen not to get killed. But it's never been an army which has really had a core of people who want to fight. If they do want to fight, it's usually because they come from a certain community. The best units are Kurdish units, but they're not really controlled from Baghdad. They're controlled from Iraqi Kurdistan.
Muqtada is a young fellow in his 30s. What role do you see him playing in the future of Iraq? Is he a central character?
Oh, yeah, he's probably the most important. He's almost the only leader, you could say, if something happened to him, the future of Iraq would be different. Most of the others are kind of replaceable. He leads the largest mass movement in Iraq, and the largest mass movement among the Shia, who are 60% of the population, and it'll be very difficult to do anything without him. I mean, the American attempts to marginalize him in 2004, when Bremer was the viceroy there, turned out to be disastrous, and they're pretty disastrous now. But there's something about him that has continually led the U.S. and indeed the Iraqi government to underestimate him. You know, and as we've just seen, when Senator McCain was in Baghdad a few weeks ago, he was saying that Muqtada's support was on the wane, and talking to diplomats in the Green Zone, you hear exactly the same thing. I never thought it was so. You heard a different thing on the street. but often people in the officials in the green zone convince themselves of something like that. And then the Iraqi government often follows what they think. But it's a persistent fact of Iraqi politics is that Muqtada, the Mehdi army, the Sadrist movement tends to be underestimated.
And that was Patrick Coburn. And again, I apologize for that tin can quality of the audio, but that was the phone system in his hotel was of extremely low quality. Patrick Coburn is a correspondent for the Independent newspaper and author of the book Muqtada al-Sadr, The Shia Revival and the Struggle for Iraq, just published by Scribner's. And we'll take a break.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is WBAI in New York, the 99.5 on your FM dial at WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Miriam Greenberg.
Hello, everybody. Oh, Madonna. This is a beautiful song.
And that a bit of Iggy Pop with some of the old Stooges singing Madonna's Ray of Light at the occasion of her induction to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think, a few weeks ago. It was a strange conjunction of personnel there. We are now joined in the studio by Miriam Greenberg, who is a professor at the UC Santa Cruz and author of the book Branding New York, How a City in Crisis Was Sold to the World, recently published by Routledge. Welcome, Miriam.
Thank you for having me.
So, let's go back into the misty decades past. How did cities get involved in this business of marketing themselves?
Well, yes, New York City was certainly not the first to attempt city marketing. I think that in the 60s and 70s, it was a period of urban crisis in the United States and more broadly, and it was also a period of fierce competition between cities and regions around the country to attract what a deindustrializing nation was finding was its main economic base, which was the service sector economy. And a lot of people who were relocating at this time, whether corporate offices or people searching for the tourist industry or trying to develop their real estate sector. And so image making and image marketing became very central as a strategy for economic development for cities.
But New York City initially had thought of itself above all that, right? The city sold itself, right?
That's right. That's right. Unlike, you know, cities like Las Vegas or Atlanta or other places in the Sun Belt that had a long sort of history of marketing themselves for tourism and entertainment and leisure, New York had a very diverse economic base historically and had not thought it was necessary, and also had a very robust media sector that it was thought could kind of in and of itself market the city through its products without any kind of concerted effort on the part of the public sector or the government or any kind of coordination. So that all changed in the late 60s and early 70s.
And let's go back to that period, the late 60s, when the city was not yet in fiscal crisis. That wouldn't happen until 1975. But there was a sense of rot and decay. You open the book with this this, I remember a lot of the stuff you write about, but I didn't remember this one. The Alitalia ad that got quite a few noses out of joint at the high level of the city, right? What was that about?
Yeah, well, actually, I don't know that it was. I mean, it was something that at the time was quite scandalous. I uncovered it at the municipal archives down on Chambers Street. And I just thought it was a great example of the kind of thing that could become a scandal for the city. It was a teaser ad that was done by Alitalia Airlines using, in the beginning, they weren't explicit about what the point of the ad was. They just showed an image of the Statue of Liberty sinking into the sea, kind of evocative of Planet of the Apes, the final scene where the Statue of Liberty is found sinking into the beach, and you know, the implication being that New York City is going to cease to exist. And there were a series of ads asking readers, you know, to keep tuned to the next ad to find out what's going to happen, when New York City is going to kind of disappear. And it turned out that the purpose of the ad was to promote a new nonstop service from Rome to cities on the Eastern Seaboard besides New York, including Boston, and Washington, D.C. And this was seen as like something to celebrate on the part of the airline, because so many travelers wanted to avoid New York when they came to the United States. And so the Convention and Visitors Bureau and a lot of Italian Americans in the city and others got together to try to protest this ad and to protest the implications that New York City was going to disappear and was a city to be avoided by tourists.
And this is the time, too, when the city became ironically known as Fun City. What was that all about?
That's right. Under the Lindsay administration, and that was a famous line by Mayor Lindsay, actually made on the eve of the transit strike in 67. And I think that it was something that was not that many New Yorkers did not really thought was kind of a bad joke, really, because the city was going through so much difficult times. But I think that I think Lindsay was somebody who was really trying to embrace an idea of New York as a kind of modish and fun place where, you know, youth culture was still vibrant and where people could come and still and have a good time. It was never an official marketing campaign, but it was something that he was trying to remind people of as an aspect of New York at a time when the city was going through the beginnings of a lot of difficult problems, from a lot of labor crises, a declining financial picture, strikes were rampant, and a lot of people were leaving the city. There was what was known as a corporate exodus at the time, where many corporations were leaving, particularly downtown and midtown Manhattan, some of the big firms. There was white flight and capital flight from the city, and he was trying to kind of evoke a funner, happier moment, and it kind of didn't go very far at that historical moment.
This is also hard to believe in the present, when the city just seems like such a bastion of wealth. Wall Street, at least until recently, had been raking it in, and playground for the fashion industry, and all the gossip, the boldface names, and the gossip pages. Why was what was happening that drive all these corporations out of town?
Well, I think that there was serious competition that was the city was facing from the suburbs, the immediate suburbs of New York in the tri-state area, as well as from this booming and expanding Sun Belt. And I think that the competition was really in two major areas. One was seen in the area of what these cities and regions could offer these corporations in terms of tax breaks and incentives to locate in their areas. And New York City had a higher tax bracket and was considered at the time, according to a lot of market reports and stuff that were being conducted, market research that was being conducted, was considered to be very anti-business, largely because of the labor activism that was here. And so these other regions in the country were considered more pro-business. They were not as intensively unionized, and they could offer a lot more incentives for corporate headquarter location. And in addition, there was the second issue, which was really one of lifestyle and image. And, you know, some of the things that New York City was accused of, I think the major ones were kind of crime, grime, and traffic. So New York City was represented as a kind of asphalt jungle that was dirty, that was crime-ridden, and that was very difficult to navigate. And this was, despite the fact that there was this great concentration of all these different dynamic firms, and, you know, there was a great advantage to being in this location as As people like Saskia Sassen and others have pointed out, you know, the agglomeration effect. Nonetheless, a lot of these firms and the workers, particularly like the mid-level employees and others and some of the CEOs, were really hyping the lifestyle of suburban America and the image of these big corporate campuses with green lawns and, you know, drive to work kind of lifestyle, as opposed to taking the subway and dealing with the chaos of what was New York City in this period. One of the things that was driving this image of this deteriorating lifestyle, by the way, as well as the image of the kind of labor activism and the diversity of the city, which the images of suburban America being mostly white were not, was the media at the time. Also, there was an incredible increase in filming on New York City streets and of representations of New York City as a kind of chaotic and in some cases declining and crime-ridden city. So that was, it was a kind of perfect storm, if you will, that was chasing these companies out.
I guess it's easy to get nostalgic for some of that in these days when the city has been turned into a mollified playground for hedge fund guys, but it was pretty harsh at the time in a lot of ways. I should say I'm speaking with Miriam Greenberg, who is the author of Branding New York, How a City in Crisis Was Sold to the World. So you have a chapter on the World's Fair, which is an image-making flop. I remember the World's Fair. I think I was 12 years old when I went to that. It was a lot of fun, but I didn't realize its larger intentions were so frustrated. Why was it a flop?
The World's Fair came at the end of you know, the reign of Robert Moses, and was something that Moses, I think, really invested an enormous amount of energy in and was hoping was going to resuscitate his reputation, which at the time, you know, was he was very much under attack. And he, in kind of typical Moses fashion, arrayed around him a group of people that were going to support his approach, and was very dismissive of a lot of the critics at the time. I mean, this was already a city that was facing financial burdens and was not in a position to really invest heavily in marketing and tourism kinds of things like the World's Fair. And so he convinced a lot of people that he was going to be able to make an enormous amount of money solely through kind of partnering with big companies that were going to come and build pavilions in the fair, but nonetheless was going to need a lot of resources from the city. There was at the time, though, a lot of, you know, in addition to the increasing debt that the city was facing because of a lot of mismanagement of investment decisions and that were going on at the time, which I can talk about later. There was a lot of unrest on the streets. This was the 60s. There was, you know, the burgeoning, the heating up of the civil rights movement, which was very much in New York City, leading to a lot of activism on the part of groups like CORE and other militant groups. And there was a lot of feeling that the World's Fair, culturally speaking, was really out of sync with what was going on in New York City. And so on the opening day, you already had massive protests in front of the World's Fair, and people who were shouting down President Lyndon Johnson in the opening day speech that he made at the fair. And this wouldn't have been such a big deal if it hadn't been for the fact that Moses had also something that was typical of Moses. He was extremely visionary, and he was working with the local media industries to an unprecedented extent to cover every aspect of the fair. So everything that he hoped would be representative of the city in this period included a lot of the chaos and protest that plagued the fair from the beginning to the end. There was constant news coverage of the fair. He was working with some of the biggest television news agencies that were based in Manhattan. He produced all kinds of publicity around the fair, but many of the magazines that put, like Time Magazine and Fortune and others that worked on that publicity, were also covering the fair in a very critical fashion. And so he kind of set up a situation in which, as did a lot of the fair organizers, in which all of the hype was elevated to such an extent that once you started seeing these negative images, the impact of the fair was kind of ultimately not as successful as he would have hoped. So he was not really able to kind of brand New York in the way that he would have hoped, or to, you know, to manage the image, to police the image as he would have liked. And I think that the failure of the fair really led to people trying to come up with new strategies to do that.
Let's move ahead to the fiscal crisis mid-70s. So first, what's your explanation of why the city hit a wall? I mean, there's many explanations of it. You know, the excessive generosity is favored by the folks up at the Manhattan Institute. But what's your explanation of why the city ran into such trouble in the mid-70s?
Well, it is a complicated question. And I think that certainly, you know, you could argue that New York City, relative to other cities, was more generous in some aspects with its salaries for municipal employees, for instance, and welfare. But I think that that was one portion of the expenditures, which actually paled in comparison with a lot of the other expenditures that were also occurring in this period, which, you know, a lot of other historians have documented, that were going to build massive amounts of private sector real estate in Lower Manhattan, such as the World Trade Center. And that had begun, there was lending that was going on for the private sector that had begun in the around 66, 67, which actually, interestingly enough, people like Robert Moses did not support. You know, he was somebody who supported building a lot of housing and other infrastructure for the middle class. And this was a lot of building that was going on for office towers and for high-end real estate. And so there was a lot of debt being incurred because, as I mentioned earlier, there was this exodus. And so a lot of these buildings, including the World Trade Center, remained unsold, remained empty. In addition, I think with the loss of tax base that the city was experiencing, that contributed significantly. And finally, the federal retrenchment, you know, the Nixon administration and the shift in policy towards cities in this country meant that mass amounts of funds were being pulled from New York and other cities, particularly older, industrialized, left-leaning, you know, democratic strongholds like New York, were losing an enormous amount of funding and from, you know, programs like Model Cities and other things. And so it was really a combination of these things. And to blame expenditures on welfare and municipal employees is really to miss the big picture.
And what resulted from that fiscal crisis was a big austerity program. To talk a bit about that?
Yes. So I think that the solution, such as it was, that was arrived at in the mid-70s, 75, and subsequently, was one that imposed what they called austerity on all aspects of public spending. There was a 20% drop in public spending between 75 and 85 over the course of the decade, and that brought New York City to a spending level that was similar to what it had been at in the mid-60s. One of the things I find interesting is that one of the only areas that was not cut was city marketing. So despite cuts in every other aspect of social spending, the city began to invest for the first time in its history in marketing itself for tourism and business. But, you know, the austerity was felt in every aspect of urban life, from education to sanitation to health, to transportation, and left an enduring legacy, I think, for decades to come to this day, I believe, in terms of the attitude towards public spending, as well as sort of notions of what New Yorkers were entitled to when it came to public services.
Of course, it's not really a very pleasant story unless you're a bondholder, I guess. But how talk about the rebranding process that went with this. Like, the city not merely was tightening belts, but then trying to reinvent its image at the same time. Who are some of the characters behind this reinvention?
Well, there was a coalition that came together, beginning with the kind of failure we were talking about with the World's Fair, and with the corporate exodus and with the dire economic straits that were particularly threatening companies that were not in a position to flee to the suburbs. So companies in sectors like real estate and tourism depended on the image of New York for their survival and future. And so you saw the creation of the first public-private partnership in the United States, apparently, according to this group, and I haven't found any other example, which was the Association for a Better New York, which is an organization that was created by a group of realtors with one Lou Rudin at the head, but a number of other prominent realtors and tourism folks, and that worked alongside of a lot of people in the media industry. I mean, I think one of the things that they learned from the failure of the World's Fair was that the media and the advertising industry had to be on board, could not be opposed to their efforts, had to help them to sell the city, and that otherwise these were industries that were incredibly powerful and were some of the only industries in New York City in this period that were actually expanding in the midst of all of this other economic decline. Largely because all these companies were buying their services to try to save themselves. And so similarly, the real estate industry tried to buy their services or get their services pro bono to sell New York in what was the first kind of quasi-official city marketing campaign, which was Big Apple in the early 70s. And then come the mid-70s, they really got the Beam administration and ultimately the Koch administration on board, and then ultimately the state on board with an even larger advertising campaign, which was I Love New York. And so there was always this kind of partnership, if you will, between city marketing efforts on the one hand and then other efforts to restructure the city and to make it more to make it seem and then in reality to be far more business friendly through its tax policies and through the incentives that it offered to business.
Now, since this show has a bicoastal audience, but also worldwide on the web, this is really kind of pioneering stuff in a lot of ways. Wasn't this exemplary? And this kind of strategy was a way of selling neoliberalism more broadly, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, what ultimately came to be known as neoliberalism, you might argue, was road tested in New York City in this period. And the fact that this was happening, the fact that New York's crisis as well as its recovery were happening so much in the spotlight of U.S. As well as global media meant that it became this kind of model for the possibilities of neoliberalism to save a massive economy like New York. I mean, that was really what was presented. The I Love New York campaign helped to sell the notion that this kind of these kinds of harsh austerity measures combined with all these pro-market reforms could really turn the fortunes of a city around. And I think Ronald Reagan, I talk in the book about how he comes in 1981 and makes this speech before the New York City Partnership, which was kind of the heir to the Association for a Better New York that came on board in 79, basically saying that New York City was the model that he wanted to follow with the nation as a whole, and the way to pull the United States out of New York City was the tugboat that would pull the nation out of the shoals of the stagflation of the 70s and into the prosperity of the 80s that he envisioned. And the model that he used was these kind of private sector initiatives and this kind of marketing. So I think that in the same way that Reagan-era America became a model for the globe and, you know, and this neoliberal approach, so did New York City.
Yeah. Morning in America was...
Morning in America, yes.
Presaged by Morning in New York City. We all became right. A city and then a nation and then a globe full of happy shoppers. Right? We're no longer citizens but consumers. Well, thank you for joining us, Miriam Greenberg. I've been speaking with Miriam Greenberg, who is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of the book Branding New York, How a City in Crisis Was Sold to the World, just out from Routledge. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I will be back next week, and let's go out with this musical delight taken out of context by PJ Harvey. Till next week. Bye.
chapters. I'm in New York, no need for words now. We sit in silence, you look me in the eye directly. You met me, I think it's Wednesday, the evening, the mess we're in and all.